100% born in the Appalachian Mountains and made in the USA, Timber Ninja Outdoors provides a range of mobile hunting options to accommodate diverse hunting preferences. Whether you prioritize comfort, lightweight design, or versatility, their two-panel and single-panel saddles collection has something for everyone. The Black Belt Nano is the lightest single-panel saddle available on the market, weighing in under a pound. The saddle is designed with the minimalist hunter in mind, focusing on lightweight functionality and breathability. One notable feature is the patent-pending magnetic stick clip system on the side, which allows for convenient transportation of sticks up the tree, as well as a built-in platform holder. The Nano saddle can be folded up to the size of a Nalgene bottle, enabling easy portability. With a four-way stretch material on the back for a comfortable fit, as well as strategically placed padding for hip pinch relief, you can use code EASTMEETSWEST to get free shipping on any Timber Ninja order. If you try it out and don't like it, send it back within 30 days for a full refund. Learn more at TimberNinjaOutdoors.com and sign up for their email newsletter for exclusive discounts and product drops. Maven makes the highest quality optics at half the price of their competitors through their direct-to-consumer business model. The brand new B7 represents the expansion of their compact lineup and is designed to be more compact and portable than their acclaimed B3 Bino. With a smaller objective lens, the binocular takes a significant leap in terms of size reduction. The B7 is available in both an 8x and 10x option, making it their most compact premium binocular yet. If you're looking for something that will fit in your pocket for deer hunting, turkey hunting, or scouting missions, but still want crystal clear optics, check out the new B7 from Maven. All their optics come with a lifetime, no-fault warranty. If you run it over with your truck or your significant other chucks it at your head, they'll repair or replace it. Use code EASTMEETSWEST-GIFT for a free gift on any full-price optics order at mavenbuilt.com. Better Backstrap's mission is to provide the highest quality seasoning for the meat you work so hard for. They wanted to give hunters another choice besides the big box store brands full of fillers and preservatives. Born right here in Pennsylvania, Better Backstrap Seasonings will turn up the taste of your wild game. Right now, you can pick up their sampler gift box, which includes gun season garlic, tall tine taco, and the original seasoning in a custom gift box. You can use the code EASTMEETSWEST for free shipping at betterbackstrap.com. For all of those that want a truck bed cover for work or play, Diamondback makes the top-of-the-line, heavy-duty covers that help you do more with your truck. They're perfect for the truck-owning, avid sportsmen, outdoor enthusiasts, and weekend project warriors. I'm currently using the HD cover that is capable of holding up to 1,600 pounds on the top, and then I have the Yakima Overhaul HD bars on top so I can put my rooftop tent on it. When I'm not using my rooftop tent and able to use the trifold design of the Diamondback, I have the Crossbin 8 in there to organize all of my stuff in the back of my truck bed. Diamondback is made right here in Phillipsburg, Pennsylvania. If you want to check them out, head over to diamondbackcovers.com.
Are you an adventurer looking to take your hunt to the next level? Then you're in the right place. Welcome to East Meets West Hunt with your host, Bo Martonic.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the East Meets West Hunt podcast presented by Spartan Forge. On today's episode, I am joined by AJ LaQuinta of Knights of the Apex. AJ runs the Bow Nerds podcast, is a talented photographer, and obsessed with archery and gear. We discuss the essential tools and skills needed to build your home bow shop on a budget. You can find the blog post that I did that goes along with this, with the gear discussed at eastmeetswesthunt.com. On this week's Mountain Buck Monday Story of the Week, we have a story from Jamie Kleinel in Pennsylvania. So Jamie wrote in and said, I woke up on October 29th, 2022, intending to hunt a different spot until I checked my phone and saw I had does on my cell camera Friday night. On the walk towards the area, I passed two fresh scrapes and then there were four more, and one was huge and still steaming. I sat in a big oak tree near some thick bedding and settled in. Nothing all morning until about 9 o'clock when I heard something behind me. I turned and caught a rack at 65 yards coming my way. I got my bow, turned around, and got ready. I ranged an opening at 35 yards, and as he stepped into that opening, I had a good shot opportunity and took the shot. I couldn't tell where my arrow had hit, but I had good blood at impact. I decided to back out since I needed to take my daughter to softball anyways. After practice, my 7-year-old son and I hiked back in and started tracking blood. We followed him for 130 yards and saw him piled up in a blowdown. What a great morning and even better PA public land mountain buck. So congrats on that buck, Jamie. Just awesome deer. And just another great story coming in here from Pennsylvania. There's been a bunch of PA ones this fall coming through, and love seeing it from the home state and seeing all the success. So again, congratulations. You can check out that post over at East Meets West Hunt on Instagram or East Meets West Outdoors on Facebook. If you have a story that you want to send in of a successful mountain buck hunt, then send it to bow@eastmeetswesthunt.com with, you know, just a paragraph or so and a few photos. I'd love to be able to share it on a future episode of the podcast. In other news, as I mentioned a little bit here in the very beginning of the intro, I wrote an article slash blog on my website with showing some of my home bow shop setup that we're going to talk about here. And I also put together a gear list with some of the items on Go Wild. And as a reminder, you can use the code East Meets West to save 10% off gear at the Go Wild app. So you can save some more money on some of these bow shop tools. Not everything's over there, but they do have some of the items. So you can save some money on some of the things that they have on the website there. But I put links to all the other items too in that blog just to be able to show. We talked about a lot in this episode, so I figured that might be another way of being able to help you'll be able to find all of the information that we talked about here in this episode. So with that being said, we'll jump right into this episode here with AJ LaQuinta. Thanks for listening. All right, AJ LaQuinta, welcome to the show, buddy.
How's it going, man?
It's good to talk to you again. I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Doing great, man. Doing great. Enjoying, I'm a new dad, so, you know, it killed the season, but for good reason. So I'm excited to have a new hunting buddy in the woods with me in a couple of years. So it's going good.
Yeah, that's exciting. I mean, I know you were kind of preparing for that at the time when I ran into you there. What was it? Beginning of October when we did that hunt with Quiet Cat out in Illinois. And that's where I first met you at. But we've ran around in similar circles for a while. So it was only a matter of time before we kind of ran into each other.
Yeah, for sure. I think we grew up hunting one state over from each other. So I grew up in hunting upstate New York. So not too far. Similar mountains, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, that was pretty cool to find, because now you live down in Florida, correct?
Yep. Yeah, so people kind of assume I hunt whitetail down here, but not really too much, honestly. I save most of my vacation days to go back up north and a lot less mosquitoes.
I can imagine. Like Florida is such a cool state, but it kind of freaks me out on the hunting side because of all the spiders, bugs, snakes that inhabit a lot of those areas. Maybe I'm thinking about it too critically, but that's kind of what I think about.
The people that make it a little more scary, honestly. I've gotten pretty used to all the animals, but down here. But yeah, it's you run into the occasional pirate on public land, that's for sure.
That's funny. So give a little bit of a background on yourself, and just kind of give a background on yourself, and then what Knights of the Apex is.
Yeah, so Knights of the Apex, I started it probably, I guess, going on almost 4 years now. So I've got a 9-to-5. I manage a compliance team for a financial firm. And I've lifelong hunter, grew up doing it. My dad was always a bow hunter. My uncle, those are the guys that I looked up to and learned from, and my grandfather growing up. So after college, I really dove into bow hunting hard. And I was at a point in my career where, like, I finally, had some change in my pocket for some better equipment. And I was just getting frustrated going to bow shops all the time. I'm fortunate. I have a great shop in the area, Adventures Archery, but I was just getting annoyed having to rely on somebody else to handle my setup. So I started working on my own stuff, investing in the equipment to do so, and just sharing it on Instagram. Because at that time, social media was really just starting to pick up for hunting, but there wasn't a ton of gear centric content out there at the time, even, you know, only 3-4 years ago. So I was just sharing it as just kind of, I created Nicely Apex just so it was more a community. I didn't want it to be a page where it was a whole bunch of selfies. And it's been great, like getting feedback and interact with people. And then, you know, over time, I really found I loved the photography aspect of it. And that's kind of grown into its own little entity. So now the page is, you know, it's cool because I get to work with brands like Quiet Cat and Montana Knife Company and some of the other ones, and, you know, work with those brands and produce content for those guys, which also gets access to gear that I can then share and talk about. And it's cool getting insight into the inner workings of some of the, you know, this quote unquote industry and getting a little more insight. Now getting to share that with people all over the world. It's pretty surreal. Like just how much all this stuff can pick up in a short period of time.
Yeah, no, you've definitely been, definitely seemed like from the outside looking in, been growing, you know, over the last 4 years. And I like remember when I first found out about you, it was funny because you're kind of like a faceless, company a little bit there. Like I knew of Knights of the Apex, but I didn't know who AJ was or like what you looked like until I started checking out your YouTube channel a little bit. And then I'd see you on there, but mostly your Instagram page and everything is product type stuff and videos and things along those lines. But it was kind of funny, to see that at first, but I liked the aspect of how much you just kind of nerded out on, for lack of better terms, on gear, on bows, and just like tinkering with things and playing with it and figuring out what works for you and what doesn't, and sharing that in a way that's not like, this is the only way of doing it or looking at it, but this is kind of how I look at it and this is why. And I think that helps people out quite a bit. And also that, you know, the idea of, you know, you wanting to learn to do some of that stuff on your own. I think that's a really important thing for people like it, that are into hunting. And now I think there's a huge importance on having good pro shops and the way that those work. But like, absolutely. Like, okay, for example, for myself, I don't have a pro shop within an hour and 15-minute drive of me, like where I live at currently. I used to work at a pro shop when I lived down by Pittsburgh, but I don't have that available now. And most people don't, you know. I get questions all the time, even from people I know locally, where can I go, or asking me to work on their stuff. But it's just like, it's a valuable skill to learn, especially if you want to play around with things and just, and mess around with that kind of stuff. So I think that's a pretty cool way you've kind of taken your business there.
Yeah, and for me, it's just been such a confidence booster in the woods, because I'm not one of these guys that spends 300 days in the field. Like I'm, like most people, I'm budgeting my vacation days for, you know, that probably cumulative week or two I get to hunt. Now, fortunately, I'm getting some more opportunities to hunt, and that's what I'm really focusing now is getting more opportunities to hunt. But you know, I'm still working with just those couple of days a year. So for me, like part of it is just, I need my equipment squared away, because the worst feeling in the world is showing up to camp and something's off and you're wondering, is this going to be okay? You know, and now like it, I used to be that guy where it was like, don't even look at my bow. But now, I mean, right before we went to Illinois, I literally restrung my bow the night before and paper tuned it and dialed it in that morning we got there, and I was confident with it the entire week. But unfortunately, I didn't get to let one fly. Not too many people did that camp, but you know, it's one of those things where it's just such a confidence booster. And then you're a value add at camp for everybody you hunt with, right? So, but I'm with you. I think pro shops, like, it's the watering hole. It's the lifeblood of the industry. Great pro shops are such a godsend. They're incredible. Like I love hanging out at shops and talking to people, and you get to just hear and learn so much, but you don't always have access to them. Like you said, and a lot of people don't. So it is important to, I think, and it's more easy than people think to start working on your own stuff and taking some more accountability for your own equipment. And it pays dividends for you when you're in the woods.
Yeah. And like I said, like it doesn't need to be an all or nothing thing when it comes to going to a pro shop or doing it on your own. It can be a supplementation of that, you know, or something happens and you need to be able to fix it right away. If you have the knowledge or the tools and capabilities to be able to do that, then you can make those quick adjustments, because everybody knows that pro shops during hunting season and leading up to it are extremely busy and the turnaround times are not quick. And that's not their fault. That's just the nature of the beast. And that's when demand is at the highest point. And I just think that it's really cool to be able to do that on your own. And especially like right now, like this time of year where, you know, mostly you're not hunting much. You're not doing, there's not a whole lot going outside. I mean, maybe in Florida where you got some warmer weather, but you know, and you start getting into Pennsylvania and some of the upper parts of the U.S., it's colder out and you're kind of inside some more. And it's kind of fun to tinker around with things and play around with some new gear and get it kind of dialed in well before the season rolls out.
100%. Now's really the time. You know, I mean, if you're buying stuff and you could rewind a couple months to like Black Friday and stuff, that probably would have been the best time to save some money. But as far as like diving into tinkering, now's the best time here because you got months to do stuff. Even if it's, you know, I always tell people the gateway drug is fletching your own arrows, right? Like Bits and Burger jigs, like they never go bad, right? Even those plastic easy fletch jigs, they're very easy to use, right? You're probably going to waste a couple of wraps and a couple of veins to start out as you learn some lessons. But all in all, you're talking, you know, 15, 20 bucks for a pack of veins. And that's something that you can mess with different vein combinations and really drastically have an impact on your groups, especially when you start playing with broadheads. And that's a pretty low cost investment into something that could have a drastic impact on your setup, your tune, and your confidence. So I always like, if someone's like just really not sure like where to start, but they want to just start doing something, start fletching your own arrows, fletch buddies' arrows. Like I think a Bits and jig is like 80 bucks. And some of those easy fletch jigs are like 30, 40 bucks. So it's not too bad. And it's something that you can do while you're watching TV, while you're hanging out with the family. And you don't need a lot of space for it.
Yeah, no, that's such a good point. Is like, so I have a Bits and Burger jig, and that's what I use personally. And that's, I learned that from working at the shop and like the amount of different things you can do with that jig specifically. But there's also, like you said, like the easy fletch, and I think there's like, I don't know, probably 15 different iterations that are similar to that now. For sure. That make it super simple that you can put all the veins on at once, you know, just add some glue, do that for like, you know, the more simpler approach to it. But it seems like the Bits and Burger is one of the oldest and also still the most reliable kind of, it's one of those things that I feel like is like a hand-me-down, you know, like you talk about like a quality knife, like MKC, like something that you hand down to, hand down like through generations. Like that's one of those things that just doesn't go out of style.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's completely analog, right? Like it's all metal and just knobs, and it's going to be good for your grandkids one day. So
yeah,
you know, it's definitely worth the investment. And you know, like I said, like, and a lot of companies, or if you have to go to a shop to buy your arrows or something like that, but a lot of even online retailers, when you order your arrows, they'll cut them for you and maybe even glue in the inserts. I think Lancaster does it for like an extra 25 cents or something like that. So the only thing left for you to do at that point is if you want to check if the arrow is squared up right, if you want to get like a little arrow squaring device, I got mine bolted to the table right now. But I think that's like, you know, again, 20, 30 bucks. What I do is I'll take like a silver Sharpie and I'll actually just Sharpie the end of my shaft and then just sand it down. And that just make sure that the end of that arrow shaft where it contacts that broadhead or that insert, that outsert, whatever it is 100% square. And then that's ensuring you're going even, you know, now you're getting into more of like the fine details of a super accurate arrow setup. And, you know, at the end of the day, the bow's only as accurate as the arrow that you got. So now you're talking maybe 100, 150 bucks. You're all in everything but an arrow saw. And you could work on all your arrows, right?
Yeah, no, definitely. And arrow saws too. I mean, like, because they're, you know, you can get some pretty good deals on arrows. For sure. And stuff that aren't, you know, cut, and being able to do that yourself. Now there is a little bit more of an investment there, but that's if, you know, especially if you're looking at from the standpoint, if you're going to do your own and, you know, you want to do some of your families or friends or whatever, and just kind of get practice with it or mess around with it, or even, you know, make a little bit of extra money helping out doing that kind of thing. It's really not hard to do. I have one of the Weston arrow saws myself. Is that what you're using too?
Same thing. I think for the money, and I know they've got a couple of different models. I think I'm looking at mine right now. It's the 120 volt with the 8,000 RPM. So I think that one's like in the upper, like just under 200, it's like 180 or something like that. I've had it for years. I've cut hundreds and hundreds of arrows with it. You know, and I know they get far more expensive than that, but I think investment wise, like you're in on that. And like you said, if you can even find, like, if you know that you've got buddies and they love to wait till the last second to get their arrows done and the shop's not going to be able to do it, right? Like, that's honestly what I did. I think my buddy, I was working on his bow so much. I think he actually bought me this saw, if I remember. It's been a couple of years now, but, I built a couple of bows up for him and a couple dozen arrows for him. And he was like, dude, you're going to keep working on all my stuff. So here, I got this for you, which pretty dope. Hopefully everyone's got friends like that.
I think the saw that I have, I'm looking at it right now on Lancaster, is the Weston, just the 8,000 RPM arrow saw, the pretty simple one. I don't have the dust collection system or any of that stuff on there. You don't need that for doing your own personal things, in my opinion. But that's something that has been a pretty sweet investment.
Definitely. I will say, if you are going to be messing around with that depth, you know, if you've got those leftover COVID masks, throw one of those on, because that carbon dust, you'll be sneezing that out for hours after a dozen arrows or two.
Yeah, that's a good point there. And I have a shop like built in my basement kind of, and like I took like the pegboard and put it on the walls, and I have all the hooks, and I have a ton of different fletchings up there that I've accumulated over the years, some extra ones and stuff that I have that I can always just kind of build, you know, mess around with arrows if I want and put them together. And it's kind of a fun thing to be able to play around with. It can be frustrating at the same time too. Like I've learned with me, I don't like switching arrow setups. Like when summer comes around, it's just like, I want to shoot what I'm going to be hunting with. By that point, you know, I'd got some arrows that were sent to me to try out last summer that I never used during the season. And I'm like, now's the time when I'm messing around with them and playing with it, because I don't feel confident in changing all of that stuff and feeling good, you know, going into the season with it.
I'm the same way. I've got two vane setups that, and the reason I've got two is because sometimes, you know, you can't find one or it's out of stock when you need it. But I've got two vane setups that are just tried and true for me and my setup, because that's the other thing. After doing this stuff for a little while, you like, I've experimented with a lot of things, but you realize, like, okay, with my draw length, with the poundage, with the type of trajectory that I feel comfortable with, this is just what works best. And that's the other cool thing, is like, now I can, you know, if I get a new bow every year or, try new broadheads and things like that, like I have a consistent arrow setup that I know what it's capable of. And if it's not, then it means there's something else that I got to work on. Either it's the tuning or the broadhead or something else is going on. So, that's the other thing. Like it's really good. Once you start working on your own stuff, your baseline, like understanding your baseline as an archer and as a bow hunter, is just that much easier to find.
Yeah. I mean, like when you look at, when you look at arrows and as people, you know, I think like when people get into archery from a new standpoint and start hunting, you know, they basically grab some expandable broadheads and throw them on, and, you know, because they're going to shoot out of the bow. And it's not, I'm not saying expandables are bad. I'm just saying that that's the easiest route for a bow that might not be tuned right, or an arrow that might not be spined correctly, all those different things, you know, but as you start, you're like, oh, maybe I want to try a fixed broadhead, and you start putting, you know, some things that might create a little bit of like a wind sail on the front of it there and trying to figure out how to steer that. That's when being able to play with the different, you know, fletching setups, making sure, you know, everything's spined correctly and make sure you're spinning all your arrows and doing that stuff can really improve that accuracy there. And having that ability at home is will save you a lot of time and money in the long run.
100%. And you know, arrow flight at the end of the day, like that's the most important thing when it comes to accuracy. You know, all of the tools that we're going to talk about, like ultimately the test for me is when I set up my phone or a camera and I take a slow motion vid and I want to launch it 50 yards or more. And just, I want to see what that arrow flight looks like ultimately, which hit my mic. But I want to see what that arrow flight looks like, because, you know, we'll get into paper tuning setups and things like that. But That's a good reference point. But ultimately, that arrow's got to track downrange because you want that arrow to hit and track just like a laser beam going into the target. You don't want that thing fishtailing. You will also, like, as you get into tuning stuff yourself, like, realize like how much you can get away with too. Like with a mechanical, I remember I set up an 80-pound bow. I think it was a Hoyt Pro Defiant. So they still had the yoke system. And this was one of the first bows I worked on. And I didn't know what I was doing. So I tuned it how, you know, I watched a couple YouTube videos and tuned it how I thought it was going to be good. And I could read the Easton logo on the side of my arrow while I was going down range. Right. But it would correct and track and hit the target almost square on, but in between, you know, those 40 yards, that thing was fishtailing. So, which is not something you want it to do, but, you do realize like, okay, well, this is like, there's, you have like such this scope of forgiveness that you can get away with too. And like how drastic you can tune stuff. And also that helps just give you a little confidence, like, okay, like this one little string is frayed, like I'm going to be okay going into the woods because I've done this 100 times and I've seen like what that means versus like, am I going to pull back and this bow is going to explode on me? Right. Like having that doubt in your head, stuff like that. Just understanding like the limitations of your equipment. Like that's, for me, that's one of the big things is working on my own stuff, just understanding those limits. It's funny because like usually, you know, my bows will be the most like out of spec out of all my buddies because I don't have time to work on my own bow a lot of times. Like I'll set it up when I first get it and it'll be pristine. And then by the end of the season, like the thing looks like it was in a train wreck. But you also like, I know like right now I'm only hunting where I can shoot 20, 30 yards here in Florida. Just that's the property that I'm on right now. So, and I know that I'm plenty accurate with the bow right there. So I'm not necessarily concerned with those marks, but that's again, from years of having just messed with these things and just knowing the setup and knowing what it's capable of.
Yeah, no, most definitely. And I know this could be a whole podcast of its own, so I don't want to go too deep on it, but yeah. The fact about, but talking about, you know, last thing about arrows, like do you, when you're going through and testing the fletchings, are you like doing a lot of different, you know, 3 and 4 fletch, you know, changing between that? What do you kind of see the benefits and everything with that?
So I did for a while. And yeah, this could definitely be its own podcast. I did for a while there, especially when I would change arrow setups, when I would change like shafts or broadheads, I would take 2 or 3 arrows and I would fletch them up with different combinations, right? Like the ones that I wanted to use. And early on, like you don't know what you don't know, right? So like I would get as many different vanes as I could get my hands on and test as much as I can. For me, what I found, the 2 setups that I really like, I've got my buddy Kyle has DCA custom arrows. So he's got these Super Saber vanes, which ironically, like we both, nerded out on arrows differently. And we both kind of found that 2.5 degree offset to 3 degree offset is just super consistent from both a grouping and an efficiency perspective. So something you'll hear guys talk about, like Levi Morgan talks about this a lot, but a parachuting effect. So if you have these vanes create drag, and if you have too much surface area or too much helical or too much vane, you're going to create more drag than you need to correct for any inconsistencies, either in the arrow tune, the bow tune, the broadhead. And what that's going to do is it's going to create a parachuting effect. So your arrow is going to drop out of the air faster. Now, does that really matter for hunting distances? Like 50, 60 yards, especially for like whitetail hunters, right? Like probably not, but especially like total archery challenge, when I start practicing at like 70, 80, 100 yards plus, I definitely see a difference when I start running, if I'm testing setups with more vane or more helical. So I really like this setup. It's just a 3 fletch. And this is really consistent, and I can tell like messing with different broadheads, how good those broadheads are now, because I know how accurate these can be. I was shooting both mechanicals. I had Severs, Rages, and then Day 6 and Iron Will. So those are 4 like very accurate setups. And I was like shocked at how accurate I could be out to 50, 60 yards. Like I was consistently hitting lacrosse ball size groups, which for me is really, really good. So that's kind of like the bar that I hold everything to after that. Because that's kind of like my limit as with my setup, as far as like how good I am as a shooter. And then the other thing, the other setup I like is this one's actually a four fletch, but this is a slightly smaller vane. So this is like a, your standard blazer profile. This is actually Easton's Bully vane. So it's still, it's a blazer profile. Boning makes it, it's just a slightly harder material. It's actually the heat vane material that Boning makes. So it's a little stiffer, which just makes it a little quieter. So the reason, and this, these group and hit exactly the same. I just found that with the slightly smaller profile, the four fletch was just more forgiving in the blazer profile than the Super Saber, which is why I run the three. But they both perform exactly the same. The reason I got two is, like I said, sometimes one's out of stock or maybe the color you wanted isn't there or whatever. Like it could be some stupid reason too.
Yeah.
But yeah, it helps to have one or two. But again, like vanes are pretty cheap. Most of the time, like you can go to your pro shop and like ask them for a couple of samples. If they don't, I think Dudley actually sells sample packs for some AAE vanes. And you can mess around, throw them on 2-3 arrows. You know, it's a pain in the neck to strip them, but that's why it helps to use wraps. And just figure out what works best for you. And especially if you're somebody that, you know, you're married to a certain broadhead that you just, it's your trusty rusty and you don't want to deviate from it. Like figure out what vein works best with that broadhead, excuse me.
The Spartan Forge app utilizes years of military background and machine learning to pull from millions of data points to accurately predict deer movement with over 30 years of GPS collar data, trail camera data, academic and state research. The app is a complete tool for planning your hunt with incredible aerial imagery, mapping, journaling, and some of the most accurate and detailed weather data. The latest update is huge. One feature that I'm using a lot during the rut is LiDAR. LiDAR basically removes the trees from the landscape and allows you to see every nook and cranny, logging road, boulder, etc., with some areas having 1 meter data, which just means that you can see any deviation in the land as small as 3 feet. During the rut, I will look for logging trails that intersect with key terrain features such as ditches or draws to funnel deer movement. Use the code EASTMEETSWEST to save 20%. And if you're still on the fence, give the 14-day free trial a chance at SpartanForge.ai. CVA has been America's number one selling muzzleloader brand for over a decade. Hunting with a muzzleloader opens up a ton of hunting opportunities across the U.S., and I've been using the Acura series. But they don't only make badass muzzleloaders. Their line of centerfire rifles are great quality and not terrible on the wallet. The Cascade short barrel is ideal for tight quarters, deer drives, and for quick shots in the big woods. You can check out their line of muzzleloaders, rifles, and accessories for every season and every range at bpioutdoors.com/CVA. If you use the code EASTMEETSWEST10, you'll get 10% off of all CVA products, which includes rifles, muzzleloaders, and accessories.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I'd went to four fletch for like 4 years. I was running four fletch and I just felt, I don't know, I had more confidence in, like, I felt like it was going to fly better with the broadheads. Well, as I started, I think it was about partway through that, I started using Iron Wills, and I was talking to Bill from Iron Will, and he was like, man, you can run a three fletch and get the same thing and, you know, get the same results out of it, but not having, you know, that parachute effect and everything else that you discussed there. And I switched to it this past year and I had noticed absolutely no difference as far as, like, it wasn't, you know, my broadheads weren't flying all over, even with the wide, you know, the wide broadheads and everything. So I was like, I'm just going to, you know, kind of stick with that. And it's just finding out kind of what works for you. But I knew that that can go a lot deeper, but I just kind of wanted to touch on that real quick before we went into the rest of the stuff.
No, and it's an important question. And that's one that I get all the time, is like three versus four fletch. And what I tell people is, if you're somebody who you're just getting into this, run a four then, because it will group tighter. You are going to have more drag, but at the end of the day, you want that confidence. Right. Like there's a very good reason. Like if you, I'll use Dudley as an example, right? Like he's the archery educator, kind of, you know, litmus test. And there's a good reason he sets up all of his buddies' bows with a 3-inch vane at a four fletch, right? Cause it's going to be super forgiving. So all of these new archers that are just learning how to grip the bow, they're probably going to torque it under pressure. They might not recognize that they have a arrow attitude, right? That four fletch is going to save them potentially from, you know, a marginal hit to a good hit, or you know, a good hit to a bad hit. So, but they're not going to have that same efficiency downrange, but they're probably not hucking it at 120 anyway, right? Or they're doing attack. It doesn't matter, right? So, it's a good topic. It's an important topic. And that's also why, like, I think it's such a good thing to start investing in if you're interested in this sort of thing, because it doesn't cost a whole lot of money and you can start doing it over time.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. So let's go a little bit like more, let's get a little more in depth. Like if you're working with, I guess when you want to set up your own bow and stuff. So bow press is like the kind of the first thing that comes to mind. It's like your big purchase that everything else kind of surrounds, you know what I mean? The bow press is kind of your foundation there. What do you run for a bow press? What's kind of your thoughts on that?
I have just the pretty standard Easy Green press from Last Chance Archery. If you wanted to upgrade, if I were to upgrade it, really the only thing I would change would be the wheel. Instead of like, it's got like a crank arm on mine. The wheel is just a little easier if you're working in the press all the time. That's why you see most pro shops use it, but you can usually find these either used or on sale for a pretty heavy discount. And then there's accessories that go right into that, right? So if you have a bow that has parallel limbs, you can adjust it for that. It's, you know, it's an add-on, but they also have draw boards that slide right into the arms of the press. So I think, like, you know, I've never felt like this press has limited my ability to tune or work on a bow. And again, it's something that you can usually find probably this time of year for cheap, as you know, or used or on sale.
Yeah, no, I run the same press myself, and I bought mine used from the bow shop I used to work at. I think I paid a couple hundred dollars for it, and I have a wheel on mine though, so I do have the wheel on it, so it makes it a little bit easier as far as cranking that down and everything. But it's worked with all of my bows that I've worked on so far. That's what's nice about it. Like, you know, I remember when I worked at the shop and we'd upgraded to some other different presses that were fancier and had some other stuff that was involved with it. And those worked great and had their own things. But I feel like this Easy press is like, it's kind of like the Jeep of, you know, like bow presses, like where you can get a ton of different accessories for it. It's, you know, it's not absolutely great at anything, but it's good at just about everything, and it has, you know, it has that capability there. It's pretty reliable and relatively cheap. I think even like the standard to buy one new is $425. I think that when I was checking on Lancaster there earlier today, but you said you can buy them used. It's not like they go bad. Like they're not, there's not much I can break on them. And I have mine bolted down to an old desk that I bought, and I don't remember where I got it from, but it was like a yard sale or something. It was an old workbench that I got and bolted to, or you could get the legs that are on it.
I took this idea. I think I saw Joe Rogan posted like a story and I saw this in the background. I was like, that's genius. I've got mine bolted to one of those Burrow brand, like the $25 wooden saws that you can pick up from like any Lowe's or Home Depot. I just have it drilled right into that. So I can actually, I've got my little setup in a spare bedroom that we've got at the house, and I can then move it around and throw it in the closet if I'm not using it or I need space in the room or something. So yeah, it's $25 to mount it to that. And then you've got a portable set up. The only things I added to mine, the wheel's nice. I'm a little jealous that you got the flywheel on there. But the only things I added to mine is I've got one of the draw boards that slides into the arms. I have the Last Chance draw board, but I think it's Archery Designs with a Z. They make, in my opinion, a bit of a more robust draw board. It uses more of like a ratchet strap than the Last Chance. Almost feels more like D-loop material. But I've been recommending that to people. I've helped a couple of people build their at-home setups. And that's a really, really solid draw board that just slides right into the arm. So it doesn't add any more space to your setup. And then the only other thing I have on there is I had my buddy Kyle Morrow from Morrow Innovations make me some 3D printed magnetic trays for like little nuts and bolts and stuff that you're working on, and Allen keys, razor blades, stuff like that. So they're just magnetic, so I can just drop all the little parts in there and I don't have to worry about them bouncing around the shop floor and things like that.
That's so big. Like, how many times do you lose things? Me personally, I've done that more times than not. I noticed that you had them for sale over on your website. I was looking at the magnetic trays there, and I think that's such a cool aspect with it. Like, I have one of the tool organizers on mine, which is nice for some of the tools there. But like, when you're working on things and setting them in places, so you don't bump the table or lose it. Like, it's just so easy to lose those little tiny components.
Especially like years ago, now most of the brands have gone away from it, but like when you were working with Eclipse and you'd pop one of those things and it'd fly across the room, and it was gone forever. You know, you just weren't finding that thing. But no, it's one of those stupid little things that's why like I bought a bunch and threw them on the website, because I was like, this just makes life so much more less stressful when you're working on bows.
Yeah, no, for sure. And so the draw board is something I don't have and that I really want to add. Like, that's, I've learned, you know, I've, you know, draw boards for tuning, and then also for like, if you're running like a QAD rest or something, that to be able to time that rest without like, you know, me, I'm trying to draw it back and trying to figure out when it's, you know, coming up. It just makes it so much easier to have that draw board at that point.
100%. I mean, I had my wife just recording it back in before I could afford, you know, throwing the draw board in there. Like, I had her just with the phone, like recording it and telling me if it was good. But so you definitely could get away with that. But it is just so much easier, like you were saying, especially if you're working with those cable driven rests, you know, and I'd even say like kind of backpedaling a little, like if you're still hesitant about investing in the press and the draw board, like if you want to start with something else, like, so you could just tie in your peeps or reserve your center serving, like invest in a serving jig. It's just a little $20 part. I think AE makes a good one. And then you can at least like cut your D loops off, reserve that center serving to get the proper knock fit, because that's a thing that robs a lot of people of accuracy that they don't think about. If their knocks are too tight or too loose, that's really going to have a drastic impact on how accurate you are and what your groups look like downrange. And that's something, again, like $20, they don't go bad. Buy the serving of your choice. I think, you know, if you want to get something that's pretty, that'll work with most knocks on the market and most strings on the market, like something in like the 1600s or 1800s is like probably a good size to start with. And then you can work on your center servings, repairing that, doing that, because those are things that'll wear out over the year, and your D-loop, right? And again, like D-loop, a spool of D-loop's not that expensive. I think you can even get 1 foot lengths off of pretty much anywhere you go. But that's like another like cost-effective way to start working on your setups. And then you're only relying on the shop for your timing and really that's it if you want the string swapped out. But the press, eventually you got to get the press, right? And the draw board definitely helps.
What about, okay, so the serving jig, that's something I don't have. I have serving and I do. What benefit does that add to have that jig?
It's really the knock fit. And I found with a lot of, especially with the factory strings on a lot of bows, you know, strings are one of those things, they're kind of like iron sights on pistols, right? Like the companies just don't invest a ton of money in, because they know most people are going to swap them out eventually anyway. So most companies, right, their strings, their factory strings, like they're okay. Like they're fine, but you're probably going to wear them out after the season. For me in Florida, like it's 70 degrees in my house, and then it's as hot as 100 degrees outside. Like I'll literally step outside and see the wax start to like sweat out of my strings just from the change in temperature and humidity. And after like a couple of dozen to 100 shots, like I'll get a significant stretch in those strings to the point where I'm actually losing poundage. So for me, like I always swap out my strings right when I get a new bow. I get an aftermarket set of strings and I keep those stock strings as a backup. I throw them in the bow case and they've saved my butt on more than one hunt. I keep them in my travel case, and you know, God forbid I nick a cable or something. All I need to do is find a press, go to a shop and just swap out that one string. But the serving jig is really helpful because, we were talking about knock fit. You know, not all knocks are the same size, not all strings are the same diameter. So that knock fit is something that it really has a drastic impact on your accuracy, because it that little piece of plastic controls how consistently that arrow leaves that bow, right? So that point of release is critically important as one of the points of consistency. So a proper knock fit, you want to have that positive click on the string, right? But you also want to be able to, what I'll do is I'll actually clip it on the string. And here, I'll grab my bow.
So for anyone that's listening here, anyone's listening, you can go over to the YouTube channel and check out the video version of the podcast, and you can see AJ as he's showing some of the stuff here on the screen.
Yeah, so I'll actually, and you might even be able to hear this, but I want to hear a click. So I want that positive click. So that way, you know, if I'm knocking an arrow in the dark or under red light when I'm getting into the stand, that I know it's on there positively. And then I want to also, though, I want to be able to slide it up and down and twist it back. Oh, I'm not on the camera. And twist it back and forth without, you can see my D-loop and my peep aren't moving. If my D-loop and peep are twisting, right, that's going to affect my tune, because especially if I'm using something like a handheld release where you're actually putting a little pressure on that D-loop, you're going to be translating that pressure to that knock, right? And twisting that arrow a little bit. And that goes into other things too. You get, you know, if your D loop's too tight on the knock and it's pinching the knock and lifting the arrow up, right, that's going to affect your tune also. But that center serving is where a lot of that proper knock fit is going to come from. It's definitely easier to swap out center serving than trying to mess around and swapping out all your knocks, because you really can't adjust the knock too much, because you can, if you try stretching it out or shrinking it, you can actually damage that plastic. And that's how you end up with dry fires and injuries that you want to avoid. So, that serving jig is definitely something, worth investing in. And again, like $20, you know, you're not in it for that much. And that's something that'll have a big impact on your accuracy potentially.
Yeah, no, I like that a lot. I think that's something cool that I didn't realize the importance of that. I typed it in on my list here to something to pick up as we move forward. Like you said, like you can do so much without the bow press too. Like you talk about tying things in, you know, D loops, that kind of stuff. That's what type of D loop material do you like, and what are your kind of thoughts on that?
So I've been using BCY number 24 rope for a couple of years now, and I like it. They also make a two-tone version, which has like a color and then black or silver. Anytime you get into colors with the BCY material, both strings and whether you're talking strings or D-loop material, the different colors seem to have an impact on like how much stretch or consistency you'll get. So that's just something to like keep in mind if you're swapping stuff out. But I've actually been working with Bloodline Fiber, who they're an actual fiber manufacturer. So they're not a string builder. They make the fibers that go into the string. So they work with, you know, like your America's Best or A3 or whoever, to actually produce the fibers that go into the string. So they're working on D-loop material right now. Strings are one of those things that the reason they actually got into it is because they're one of those areas in archery where we had like a good enough product and nobody really bothered to develop it anymore. So technology when it comes to coatings and materials has come a long way in recent years, but it hadn't made its way to the archery industry. One of the reasons I'm such a big proponent and I've started working with these guys is because they use a polymer coating on their strings. So you don't need wax. So that makes a more consistent string, because wax is subject to the elements. So that's why like in moisture, humidity, elevation, all these things, you'll get some variation in your bow's tune. Whereas if you're using a waxless string, you're not subject to that same thing. I'm able to, we were shooting in the rain one day. I could literally shake my bow off, and at 50 yards, I was less than an inch lower on my point of aim, point of impact, which that could just be the difference between the drag of the rain hitting my arrow or not. That's something that like I've never experienced that with, you know, back when I was like waxing my strings all the time. So that's something like, you know, if I was to recommend an upgrade, you know, make sure you're like keeping your eye out on your strings and your D-loop. Just every season, if your D-loop, you know, check your D-loop throughout this, every time you knock an arrow, quite frankly. I like to tie in my servings on either below the knock or one below the knock and above the knock. And then I'll put my D loop around that. But I think you can see that on there. So there's just a little knocking point above my arrow and or above the knock and below the knock. And then my D loop goes on either end of that. The reason I do that too is because your D loop is going to be one of the first things to wear out. And when I swap that, I don't want to have to retune the bow. I don't want to have to paper tune it again. So if I have those serving, those knock points tied in there, I can just cut my D loop off, swap out my D loop, and I don't have to worry about my knocking point shifting at all. That's something that like I'm glad like a lot of shops have started doing that more, but I know like for a lot of people, shops don't do that. But that's something, again, like if you just something you can do on your own, and just make your life a little easier when it comes time to set up that bow.
Yeah. And I think that's I'm glad you brought that up because I started doing the top and bottom on mine, because I was wearing out D loops. I shoot a lot, so I was wearing them out a lot, but also I didn't realize that on my knock to it, I had a little burr. Mm-hmm. And I was just ripping through D loops. So I was going through different materials trying to figure it out because I couldn't see the burr. Like it was so small that I couldn't figure it out that it was there. And then Levi Morgan and a lot of other people had, maybe even you had recommended it to me through Instagram when I'd asked, I don't know, it was a couple of years ago now. And I put the BCY24 on and I liked that a lot. And it was even holding up with that burr for a long time where I was going through other ones in, 3 or 4 weeks. So it was pretty incredible how good that lasted. And once I got that release kind of sanded down and I went back and forth between that and another release, that D-loop lasted me all year. But having the serving, tied in between there, like you said, when you do wear them out, then you can take that off and you don't have to go through and retune your bow essentially and make and because if you can't get that D loop in the exact same spot, it's really difficult to be just as accurate as you were before that.
100%. Yeah. And certain releases will just chew up D loops more than others. Just based on the claw design and things like that. Most of like the higher end ones, like once you start getting to like Noctua, True Ball, Ultra View, like that range, they're pretty good. But I know like some of the handheld releases I used in the past, like I'd go through D loops all the time. And so that's something to, that's just one thing. You're knocking your arrow anyway. Like take that extra half a second to inspect that arrow, especially when you're practicing. It'll just go a long way. Nobody, I think you shoot it long enough, you'll punch yourself in the mouth eventually, but I try to avoid that as much as possible.
Most definitely. What do you run in for a bow vise? Like what are you using and then what do you kind of think about those?
I love them. They're great. I actually haven't invested in one yet. Just because they are pricier, like of the accessories, they are pricier. And if you have the press, you can get away without the vise. Like I know a lot of guys love throwing the bow in the vise and they put the levels on their arrows and the string and that's their starting point for tuning. Personally, I don't like, and I didn't start out doing that. And I was able to tune well enough without it that I couldn't bring myself to spend the money on it. 'Cause they are expensive. I think they're at least like $100, if not $200+. It's always like, it's still now one of those things where like, I've been to like when I'm working at shops and stuff and helping people out, like it's great having it. And I'm like, oh, I really need to buy one of those, but I always have it in the cart and I just can't bring myself to hit that checkout button on it.
So how are you doing that without that? I'm curious as far as like, how are you, getting like, 'cause the way I use mine and I have a cheap one that I've spent $40 on and it sucks bad. It's it's an American Archery product one. It's just a yellow thing that basically you bolt on and then there's like these big, heavy kind of like screws in there that you can tension it down and it never stays in place and it's difficult. And when I worked at a shop, we always had the October Mountain products, like the ones that move around on the swivel there and you can tilt it at different angles. They're the freaking best, but they're $200+.
Yep.
And that's where I've kind of struggled with, buying that myself. But I'm curious to hear kind of how you're doing that.
I've been bugging the guys at Quattro Archery. They're a small South African company. They make the stabilizers that I use, but I've known those guys for years, and I've been bugging them to come out with like a less expensive vise because I really want one. But like you, like I haven't done it. But for me, I actually, and this is something that, you know, like going back to like everybody does it different, I eyeball it. I know a lot of guys that honestly eyeball it, but with the, when I was shooting a Matthews, it was super easy because the cams are symmetrical, right? And then the bows are designed so you shoot through the center of the riser, right? So that was super easy from a tuning perspective, because if my cams are in time, right, then just like rationally, my ideal knocking point should be in between those two cams, right? As long as your riser allows for that clearance, then your knocking point should be dead center in the middle of those two cams. And I think Levi Morgan, actually heard this is how he sets his up too. So before the QAD, the integrated rest even came out, I would actually set my knocking point first, and then I would adjust my rest to be roughly, you know, so my arrow's at a 90 degree angle with my bowstring, and that would be my starting point. And then for left and right, I would go off. I always forget what the measurement is off the riser, but I would use that like standard measurement off the riser. And I usually pretty close to on. With the PSEs, same thing. They have the symmetrical evolved cams. But like with the primes, you can't do that because their grip is in the center. So they don't allow for the clearance. So with something like that, and Hoyts were the same way. I shot Hoyts for a lot of years. What I would do is kind of the traditional method of, I'd set up my rest so the arrow, the shaft is running through the center or the top half of the burger buttonhole. And then I would just adjust my knocking point. Usually bows like that tend to like a slightly knock high setup. Yep. So I'd be pretty close to 90, little knock high. So I'd probably put, I'll mark it with a Sharpie where I'm at, and then I'll probably put my knocking point where that Sharpie mark is, so it's pushing the knock just a little higher, and then I'm usually pretty close. I'm within like one hash mark or so of adjustment when it comes time to paper tune. So that's something, again, like you can get away with. I think everything else that we'll probably talk about will be like a nice to have after the equipment we mentioned, and it makes your life a little easier having like the levels and stuff like that. But depending on your setup, you don't necessarily need it.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. So the way I've always done it is like with my primes is I've always taken the rest and I set it up through the center of the burger buttonhole, and then I go and I'd set it just a little bit knock high, and I'd use, you know, a level that was on my string and kind of making sure my bow is level, and then I'd put one on the arrow, and then that's how I'd kind of set that up there. But and I'd always tie the serving on the top first, and then get it down to where it was. And then that's how I was going through and doing that essentially.
Yeah, that makes sense. And the newer PSEs have been like that for me too. Because the grip's a little, I'm really running close clearance wise, depending on the vein and rest setup. So I do something similar for those too now.
Yeah, no, that's, and I think that's a good point that you made as far as like anything else we talk about are really nice to haves versus you know what you necessarily need for it. I mean, all in, what do you think, like I probably should have prepared you for this up front, but what do you think, like all in, that you could be on the cheap side as far as having a pretty effective like at home setup?
Well, going through what we just talked about, right, so if we do, let's say, and we'll be like moderately conservative, right? So let's say bits and burger jig, arrow squaring device, right? And we'll keep materials out of it, so not including veins and glue, but bits and burger jig, arrow squaring device. If we throw a saw in there, press, draw board, and then I'm trying to think if we mentioned anything else that was like necessary. But you're talking about like probably 750, you know, maybe to $1,000 on the high end if you wanted to like get everything brand new and you didn't take advantage of any sales or anything like that. Like, so you're talking about the price of a bow, right? Which if you're somebody that buys a bow or pays a shop to tune your bow, you know, a couple of times, you know, once a year, like that'll pay for itself like pretty over a couple of seasons.
Yeah, no, most definitely. And then like some of the things that aren't really expensive, like the essential tools, like I like that little Pine Ridge Allen wrench set.
Yep.
I like, that's what I take with me, like in my travel kit when I go. And then I have my own separate Allen wrenches that I just keep on my bow press, just so I'm not taking them from one place to another. But you can essentially use both of those. But I like that Pine Ridge setup as far as the Allen wrenches. Those seem to work pretty well. D-loop pliers, I think, are super important. Those have made my life easier with tying D-loops and putting them on.
They're definitely better than any way you cut it. They're better than using just normal pliers. I have done that too, but the D-loop pliers are great. They definitely make your life easier. The other things I've got that are add-ons, I like the Hamsky Easy Third Axis adjustment. So can I grab that?
Yeah, I'm glad you're saying that too, because that's one of the other things that I was looking at that I want to do, because I'm sick of going out to the corner of my house and drawing my bow back and running it up and down, hoping I don't accidentally hit my release, and then trying to figure it out. And it's not the most effective way.
Yeah. And that is a way you can get away with doing it. So for those that don't know what Bo's talking about. So if you have a straight line, like any level straight line that you can trust, like the corner of your house, hopefully is level and straight. Yeah. But you come to full draw, and you always want to test your third axis at full draw. So you come to full draw and you trace that line with the side of your bow, and your level on your bubble should stay level the entire length of that line. So like another way you could do it, if you've got a one story house like me, is I used to hang a string from the ceiling with like a little weight on it to get a level. But if you want to get a tool, Hamsky makes a little easy leveler tool. So what you do is you drop, this has a level in it. So you put this on the tower of your bow sight and just tighten it down on there. And then what you actually do is put it in the draw board and draw the bow back to full draw, and then adjust the third axis until it matches up with the level on your tower. And the reason you want to test that at full draw is because your risers actually torque under pressure. So as the pressure from your string transfers to your cables, that riser is going to torque. So that's what's going to cause your third axis to be off if you don't adjust for it.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. And so that's where it'll affect you on your uphill and your downhill shots with your sight. And I think that's something that gets overlooked quite a bit. And I remember the first time that I really noticed that was when I shot Total Archery Challenge for the first time, and I was shooting downhill at longer distances, and I was hitting off to one side or the other, depending on if it was uphill or downhill. And I was like, okay, yeah, my third axis is not on.
Yeah, and that's a good thing, like having that trick like you talked about with the corner of a house. That's a good thing. Or if you have this tool to check when you get into camp too, especially if you fly into camp, or you know, you're on a road trip and you had the bow in the bed of a truck or something, like sights take a beating even in good bow cases. So that's something that's just it's just good for you to understand how to check.
Yeah, most definitely. What about anything else? Do you have like a chronograph or anything like that?
I had a chrono. It seems like every inexpensive chrono is also unreliable. So I know even good chronos are a little finicky, especially under artificial lighting. So I think it's a nice to have, especially if you're like a YouTuber that loves talking FPS and stuff like that. It's nice. But I had one. I actually just got rid of it just because, like I said, it was so unreliable, and I would rather just make some space in the room. Other things that I've got, I've got a tape measure just so you can measure your axle to axle, your brace height, make sure those specs are on. You know, Torx wrenches, just like your Allen wrenches, a lot of bows are starting to use that. You want to have whatever essential tools for that. And then the other thing that I think is helpful for just checking your specs is something to measure the poundage of the bow. Last Chance Archery, I have their older one, which is starting to creak on me, and that is a little terrifying, but they have a new Gen 3. I think it's a little red one, but it's just a digital scale. So you can pull your bow back with it, and it'll tell you what your true poundage is of your bow and what your holding weight is as well. And that's a good thing to have too, if you're someone that travels, because I use that for making sure my luggage is within the airline limits, so I don't get hit with those baggage fees too.
Yeah, actually, that would be a. So I don't have No, actually, I think I do have one of the draw weight, but I don't think I've used it. And I have one of the ones that is it. So is the one that they have, is that where you actually draw it back and you're holding it, or is that one that you like pull down on the bow?
I like the one where you actually pull back on where you're holding it and you actually pull back, because you can knock an arrow with it. I've seen people pull strings off of limbs using that vertical pull down, like even in shops and stuff. So not to say that doesn't work. It definitely does. But I like having a little handheld one, because it feels just like pulling back the bow and I can have an arrow knocked. It just seems a little safer.
Oh yeah, the pull down ones, because I think that's what I have and it's still in its case, because I remember how afraid I was every time I'd be at the shop and have to check it and like make sure you don't want it, obviously, for it to lock at full draw. Like you have to get to like the point where it's like right before and then let go and make sure you're not torquing it at all. It just scares the shit out of me when I think of using that thing. And I so one that you can draw back with it in your hand and have an arrow on there makes me feel way better. And I think I'm going to look at adding that to my thing as well, because it's just, like I said, it gives me that peace of mind. And then also for the luggage thing, because like, so how I do it now is I stand on my scale and then I like pick up my luggage and I stand on it and subtract the weight. But sometimes the luggage is too big that I can't see the scale, and then I get off and it disappears and it's just a pain in the ass.
We've all been, that's when what was that, our math class from back in grade school actually pays off remembering how to do that. But
yeah.
And then I think the only other thing I really use is I've got a little scale for measuring my arrows. But that's it. And that's, you know, honestly, like if you're making your own arrows, like that's one of those things, like going back to like talking about, you know, what you can get away with. I realized, having built hundreds, if not thousands, of arrows over the last couple of years, like if it's within 5 grains, I am not going to notice a difference especially at hunting and even tack distances. With my level of shooting, at least, I'm not Levi Morgan, so I maybe that varies, but I know for a while everybody was really trying to get within 1 grain of each other, and honestly, like I didn't notice that. It's really like it's got to be like 10 grains plus, and once you get consistent building arrows, I don't get more than like 2 or 3 grain variation, even if I'm like totally not paying attention to what I'm doing with the glue and stuff like that. So that's one of those, again, like nice to have. It's cool to know what your arrow weight is, officially, and not, you could obviously run the calculator. Most websites give you the stats for the weights of the components and whatnot, but it's just nice knowing exactly where your arrows come out to. So that's another like nice to have, but definitely not a necessity.
And it's cheap though too. Like I think the one I have, I bought for under $10 or somewhere around there. I mean, it's not probably the most reliable thing, but it seems to work pretty good and measure that.
Yeah. And that goes back to like if you're looking to change arrows and stuff like that, like I realized over the years, like I really like a 450-ish grain arrow. Like that just always seems to be, out of my setups and my draw length, like what I feel most comfortable with, the trajectory, with how it shoots. So that's just a cool thing to know, right?
Yeah, no, most definitely. And yeah, that's the same here. And I've actually found that like, even when I switch arrows, if I get something pretty close, like you said, within 5 or 6, 7 grains, they're pretty much shooting the same. So like I can go, and as long as they're the same diameter and everything, like I can go out and test different arrows on the same bow, same sight, and not be worried about losing them through the yard.
Yeah, it's always, I always lose a couple if you got to make your own sight tape with a brand new setup. So that's never fun, just kissing brand new arrows goodbye.
No, it's not. I actually just found, like, I think because it's like when it's wintertime here and you have the ground thawing and then freezing and thawing, and it kind of changes things. All of a sudden, arrows that apparently I've lost over time, like, start to resurface themselves that I couldn't find, that like went underneath the grass and stuff, that when I missed the target. And I'm like, just the other day I was out there and I found like a piece of a back of an arrow. I'm like, I look forever for this thing. Like, why couldn't I have found it then? But here it is just sitting on the top of the ground. But it's kind of funny.
Yeah, the ground's too porous here. It just soaks up. Even on pass-throughs on animals, I've had arrows just disappear. And I'm just like, I don't understand. Like, where this went to the upside down or something. I don't get it. But
yeah, no, that's funny. But no, I think we ran through that stuff pretty good, and it was nice kind of talking through it. And as I'm, you know, I'm going to be setting up another bow here shortly and just like playing around with it. And it's just, it's fun to kind of geek out with it and play with different setups. And you don't even have to geek out on it and like want to try different things. It's just nice, like you said, to be able to work on those things yourself if you want. And if you're having problems, not have to make a special trip somewhere. You can make those little adjustments and be back in the game.
Yeah. And I'd say it's definitely one of those things where if you are going to get into it, like, and you're between like, oh, it's a little more money for the last chance versus this, or it's a little more money for the bits versus that, like go with those things that are, like we were saying, heirloom quality, because, you know, if a plastic piece breaks, like you're going to have to get another one. It's going to cost you the same distance, same thing anyway. But like those little things, like the bits doesn't go bad, the last chance doesn't go bad, and the draw boards, things like that all sticks around for years and years and years. So it's just something that it's an investment in your hunting if you got the space and the time to do it.
Yeah, no, most definitely. I'm excited to play around with it and set up some new bows and stuff. Are you are you testing any new setups right now, or what are you doing?
Yeah, I should have a new bow. I think actually PSE launched the new bows as we were talking here. So hopefully I'll have a new bow here shortly, and we'll be setting that up. But I actually I'm getting ready to write an article for Dialed, because I went to my shop and shot all the new bows from all the manufacturers, and there's so many freaking good ones. So yeah. I'm hoping I'll get some coming through my house from buddies and whatnot that I'll get to set up and work on, because there's just, it's such a good time to be a bow hunter. I love that. That new Prime really impressed me. That was just a comfy bow to shoot. And the Bowtech, actually, that Carbon One was felt really great too. Yeah, there's just so much good stuff out there. It's just, you know, finding what flavor ice cream do you like kind of deal. But yeah, just a lot of cool stuff. So I'm stoked to be following along. I think, I'm sure there's new stuff dropping as we're talking, but definitely cool.
Yeah. I've said this, you know, when I worked at a bow shop, everything, like, it was go in there and yep. shoot the different manufacturers. You know, I obviously like shooting the Primes. I love yep. the feel of them. But try them all out, see what fits yeah. you the most, and go in and play around with them and see what bow fits you the best. What, you know, don't, you know, I remember when I was first, when I first started out, I was like, Matthews was just like, it was just Matthews or nothing. Like, that's if yep. you wanted a good bow, it was a Matthews. And I'm not saying Matthews doesn't make a good bow now, they do, but like, it was just, that's the way I looked at it. And I went into, mm-hmm. when I finally, after having a bow that was, you know, 15 years old, went to get a new one, I just wanted the new flagship Matthews when I had a job out of college to get, because it was like, that's just what you're supposed to do.
Yep.
And once I learned of like being able just to try them out, and that's when, you know, when I first, the first, I think the Logic was the first Prime that I had owned. It was because mm-hmm. I went through and shot all the different ones. And
that was a great time, bow too. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was the bow that I wanted to shoot. And there's mm-hmm. all the manufacturers make some really great bows now, especially, you know, the top manufacturers that have been around for a while. They make some really good bows. It's just what fits you, kind of fits your style, what you're looking for with it. And I think that's what's really cool about it.
100%. And I'd say, like, if your shop lets you, like, bring your stabilizer, and if you can bring your sight, like, cause remember that I think a lot of people, they probably go in, shoot a couple arrows through a bear bow at a target that's 5 feet away, right? You're blank balling it. And that, you know, especially now, like, all of the bows are so dead in the hand. You really want to see, like, how's that thing actually going to balance once you start strapping your necessary accessories to it?
Yeah.
You know, I know, like, you know, Matthews has been so dead in the hand, and everybody now is finally catching up, but they sold a ton of bows because you'd go in and shoot that thing and it made no noise. Right. But that's, you know, now everybody's kind of right on top of each other with that. So the only way you're going to tell is, like, how's this work with the stuff I already have or the stuff that I plan on running? So make sure, like, if you can, take that stuff into account, because it makes a difference, right?
No, it definitely does. And it, you know, it depends on how the bow balances out, as far as, like, you know, if you're running a big back bar or you're doing different yep. things like that. Like, I realize with my prime, with having the center grip, I don't need to run like a whole bunch of weight or anything like that. Some people do like that. So that, you know, might not be the best fit for it, but like it, you're like, what you're saying is what you like to use and your accessories that you have on there. Or if you have like a big heavy spot hog out there on the front of it, like it's going to weigh a little bit more, and make your bow's going to be a little bit top heavy when you have that on there.
It's so subjective too, because what one guy likes, and that you could take two killers and they'll have totally different setups, right? Like it's really like what grip feels great to you, what, you know, with a back wall, like some guys like a spongy back wall, some guys like a hard back wall. It's so important to just test them all and figure it out. And, you know, try not to let too many voices get in your head with that. That's, you know, obviously like we've all got our brands that we like, but a lot of that comes down to, we all recognize that like they're good and we like the people behind those brands as well. Right. Like, but all of the, I agree with you 100%. All the new bows coming out, especially the last couple of years, they're all phenomenal. It's just figuring out like what's going to work for you and how you hunt and what you're hunting too. Like I love a 33, 34 inch bow. It's just a little too big for the areas and the types of stuff. Like I can't get into some ground blinds or some areas or just with a bigger bow like that. So figuring all that stuff out's important.
No, definitely. And the last thing that I'll say is like about, I guess like the different bows and everything is, I know you've had some influence with the site that I've been using, the dialed Arxo site and everything. And what's your role kind of been in with helping those guys out with that site?
Yeah. So I was fortunate that, and I don't know if I intended it this way, but so, Kyle, who I mentioned earlier, from DCA Custom Arrows, he's actually friends with Bill from Iron Will also. He's another engineer, like just brilliant engineering mind. I don't know if he or somebody else kind of tapped me just for some like input from like an end user, like, hey, you talk to a lot of people, you nerd out on this stuff, what do you think? And I got looped in pretty early on when some of the first CAD drawings were coming out, just had pretty consistent meetings. So I got to have a lot of input from like a end user perspective, like what I would like to see in the ultimate like hunting site that I could use for tack and having fun as well too. Right. So, I don't want to overplay my role at all. I think my one meaningful contribution was, I told them to put a little window. So when they do have that light that comes out, it lights up your bubble too. That's probably my claim to fame on the site, but I did get to talk to them and help out with like some of the adjustments and just what feedback like I've received from people, having shot like a lot of sites and talked to a lot of people, and just give that feedback, as a tester, for Dialed. And, you know, I love those guys over at that company. You know, I like that they're bringing something new to the table. I think sites are one of those things where, so much stuff in archery, we get to a point and then we're like, okay, it's good enough. And nobody really develops on it in a meaningful way any further. Like most sight companies, if you look at their sights, they've gotten more complicated over the years, not less, which is really not what you want to do. Like from an engineering perspective, you want to be eliminating parts and redundancies, and because those are all potential failure points, right? So, for me, I was sold on the design early on. I thought it had a lot of promise, and I'm super stoked with how especially the latest production models have come. But I get hit up with that pretty regularly. And I'm honest with people, like even going back to my first prototype site, which was really just, I got right here. This thing was just a 3D, there's the screws coming out. This was just like basically a proof of concept. Most of the parts were 3D, just to like prove that like the design could work. It wasn't meant to be like a production model. And so this front tower has like a good amount of wobble, and I was able to hit as well as I can shoot out to 140 yards at tack with this thing. So after that, I was pretty sold on it. Like any company, I'm sure they're going to be making updates and changes and refining things over time, but I'm pretty stoked on it. And I think for like an all around sight for somebody who like for me, when I whitetail hunt, I keep my sight mostly set to 30, and I just know where my holds are at closer distances out to like 40. And then anything further than that, I want to dial it precisely. But that's just kind of how I hunt. So for me to be able to do that with the Arxos and then go to TAC and be able to shoot out to 140 and have an actual pin for that is a lot of fun, because for me, like, what I try to do for Knights of the Apex is just like, I want to get people stoked on archery, because bow hunting's such a overwhelming thing to get into, right? And there's so much to it, and there's so many facets and little niches that you can like really nerd out on. But for me, like, I just really connected with the tuning part of it. And if I can make archery more digestible for people, hopefully that opens them up to potentially going bow hunting, or at least knowing about bow hunting, and then getting them out to the tack or going out into the woods. So for me, like, you know, the Arxos is a great solution for those people. So yeah, I mean, hopefully that didn't come out as a sales pitch. I'm not getting paid by them. So
No. I just knew that you had some sort of a, you know, impact with that, or helping them out a little bit, and I'd use the site. So that's why I'd use the triple pin that was at the time a prototype, and, there. And I loved using that site and getting to have it, because I always set my top pin for whitetails at 25, and then the speed of my bow, I think the second one's like 38 somewhere in there, and then maybe 50 or so. I can't remember exactly what the layout is off the top of my head now, but I have, yeah, it goes depending on the speed of your bow, and being able to have those pins, I don't really need to adjust. I can have it there and have it set, so it's pretty nice.
And I like that they're open to solutions that the customers want to see. Like, I think that's such an important thing. Like, they didn't have to make a bracket for the UltraView scopes, because obviously they have their own sites. But like, I bought, my wife actually bought me for Christmas one of these three pin, the new three pin from UltraView, and I know they're working on a bracket for that. You know, it's cool that like they want to do that. They want to create solutions for people, and they want to solve problems for their customers. Not just kind of force another product down people's throats, which is something that's like really refreshing.
Yeah, no, I think it's really cool. So AJ, what are you going to be working on this year? What's, you got any big plans for 2023?
So I'm going to be at, I'm going to be at, Winter Strong for, Sorenex coming up in February. I'm going to be helping them out with, some content, and, probably ditching away to get to partake in some of the activities and festivities they got going on there. But other than that, definitely going to be hitting up a Total Archery Challenge, probably planning a little vacation to Montana, and hopefully I'll get over to PA too, because I had a lot of fun at that event last year. And then other than that, I'm really going to try and get out for more hunting this year. I'm going to try and get some turkey, some Osceola time in here in Florida, and then head up to New York for the opener there in May. And other than that, I'm going to be doing a lot of, haven't planned any whitetail trips. I'm going to just be doing a lot of urban stuff. So I grew up on Long Island, New York. So it's a lot of suburban hunting there. And that's what me and my dad do a lot of, and we've gotten some access to some pretty cool properties over the years. So I'm going to carve out some time, get some family time, hunt with my pops. And then I'll be back here in Florida trying to get one of these swamp bucks on the ground, because they've been just a real pain in the butt. And I've got the itch to just get one of these guys real, real bad. So,
yeah, I can imagine. It sounds like a challenge down there for sure. And it's cool. It's cool that you do the suburban thing, you know, on Long Island. I think that's a cool, I've talked to some other people, not through the podcast, but that hunt Long Island and everything. And there's some big deer running around there too.
Surprisingly big. Even here in Florida, like I had, you know, I finally got permission to a little 2-acre chunk of property, and I was surprised what I had on camera. And I think honestly, you were a big inspiration for me on this. Like, you know, I think a lot of us, especially on the East Coast, we always look at like those guys out West and like doing the elk hunts and things like that. But, you know, like seeing guys like you that really dive in and invest on what's in your own backyard and what's accessible. And like, that's just the style of hunting. Like for me, that was one of the things that really pushed me to really wanting to invest more time in hunting Florida more, however I can, because this is where I live. Like I love this place. I want to understand it. Like I feel like I can't call myself a hunter if I don't understand how to hunt my home state. Right. Like that's just doesn't feel right. So for me, I want to, you know, just keep working on those types of hunting that I did growing up, keep working on what I am, where I am now. And for me, as long as I'm taking a mature buck for the area, I'm happy with that. And or even taking does to fill the freezer. That's my goal, is the memories, the freezer. And that's, you know, I mean, that's something that guys that don't kill 200 inch deer say, but, that's what I'm going to justify to myself.
No. I think that's important to want to do that in your home state and fit and that doesn't mean like that's not a justification by any means, because like they're not there. Like, you can't hunt something that's not there, and you got to look at realistic expectations for what, and this is just my opinion, but realistic expectations for what you have and what you're looking as an outcome as far as a goal of, you know, if you're happy with shooting a mature buck or you're happy shooting a yearling, like, it don't really matter. It's whatever you're going to go home and be happy with looking at yourself in the mirror at the end of the day. So like, that's the way I look at it. And everyone's going to have a little bit different goals. And that's why I've liked hunting the big woods, the mountain bucks that don't always tote the biggest racks on top of their head, but it's the whole everything about it that I love, like the whole experience and the fun of figuring them out and the places that they live, is just like, that gets me going. And I think that's cool. Like, my tagline has always been for East Meets West was kind of, which is weird that I had it as a question, because I don't think that should have been that way, but how do you define adventure? And it's like, really, it's yours to define no matter where you're at, and kind of, yep, and figuring that out. But
And now that I have a family, right? Like, that's something else that you got to take into account too, right? Like, I would rather hunt more than hunt less, but get a bigger animal, right? So like, if I can hunt suburban more often and, you know, bring my son there, that means more to me than if I blow my whole bonus on an outfitter hunt and I only get to go on that one hunt, right? Not that that's bad. I've done that plenty of times, and it's great getting to see those big bucks and, not having to do as much of the legwork for it. But I value the time in the woods and the time with family. So that's what I'm looking forward to for this year.
Awesome. Well, cool. Tell everyone where they can follow along with your stuff, check out, you know, everything that you're putting out there.
Yeah. So Instagram is where I'm definitely most active. It's Knights of the Apex, Knights with a K. And same thing on YouTube. Going to be getting back to that. And then one of these days I'll restart the Bow Nerds podcast, which, you know, we do deep dives on gear, and we have people from within the industry, engineers, guys behind the companies, actually giving insight into some of the products that, like, we talk about and what goes into it. So that's something that going to be working on more in the next year as well. And then knightsoftheapex.com, got some little accessories for your at-home bow shop if you know, you're tired of losing little parts and stuff.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm gonna hold you accountable for keeping that podcast going or restarting it, getting it rolling. So I'd be looking forward to that.
Well, thanks for having me on, Bo.
Yeah, thanks, buddy.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of East Meets West Hunt with your host, Bo Martonic. For more great content and to stay up to date, visit eastmeetswesthunt.com, Facebook at East Meets West Outdoors, and Instagram at East Meets West Hunt. If you enjoyed today's episode, please review and subscribe, and we'll catch you next time.